Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. It's my pleasure to welcome our audience live here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. It's also my great pleasure to introduce Congresswoman Helen Tauscher, who is going to introduce our speaker tonight, Candace Shy Hooper, who's written on Lincoln's General's Wives. Congressman Helen Tauscher suggested that Candace speak, and she is responsible for this event. In addition to that, she knows Candace. So, Congressman Tauscher.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm really thrilled to have my friend Candace Shy Hooper here today. I've known her for so many long years. We first met, in the early 80s. We have a very close mutual friend. This was way before I moved to California, way before I went to Congress. But we've been friends all these years. And a few years ago, Candy talked about her passion for Lincoln's General's Wives. And I was in the House on the Armed Services Committee, and I realized that she knew more about military history than virtually anybody that I'd ever met. And part of my job when I was in the Congress was to be on the board of West Point. And it really gives you a kind of up-close version of what happens with people that are military families. As we know, we have a great tradition in this country. We have many, many families that have generation upon generation that not only served during time of war, but that have really been the military leaders. And what's neat in this year of the woman is that we have Candy writing about the women that were so influential in making sure that Lincoln had the advice he needed in supporting their husbands and supporting all of the people that were involved in the Civil War. I just wanted to say thank you to Candy for coming. Thank you for writing this great book. I'm really interested in what her next book is going to be. I think you're going to really, really enjoy this. She's not only a scholar, but she is someone with a heart of gold and someone with whom I've known her family for a long time, her husband, but she is somebody that I'm immensely proud of. And when I knew the book was coming out, I asked George Dobbins if it would be a good idea to have her come here. And of course, we at the Commonwealth Club like smart things. And so you're going to really enjoy this. Then let me introduce you to Candy Shy Hooper.
Thank you, Ellen. Ellen has been such a great friend for so many years and is somebody that I admire tremendously. And the one thing that I really do want to mention, too, is that we've bonded over many things through the course of our time in Washington and elsewhere, but very much so over the fact that we both had fathers in the United States Navy. And so we bonded very much as they say, as Navy brats. I want to also thank George Hammond, who was so great in helping to set all of this up, and we really appreciate it, and I thank you all for coming. I've talked about my book from coast to coast. Well, this is the first time on the West Coast, but every place I go, I try to at least find something that can relate between the place that I'm talking and the stories that I tell in the book and the people that live in my book. I had a little bit of a hard time in Wyoming, a little bit of a hard time in Houston, but there were some trails there. But of course, here in San Francisco, I mean, you all have just such an overwhelming connection to so many of the people in this book and to the Civil War. I won't bore you with it, but I might just remind you of the things that really struck me as I came into town from the airport. The first chapter of my book, in fact, opens talking about Jesse Fremont. Now, Jesse Fremont is Jesse, talking about her first trip to California in 1849. She traveled with her two-year-old daughter, Lily, on what was then a very treacherous journey, which I describe in detail from her writings. She came here and with her husband to join her husband, John Fremont, who, of course, has a very rich history in this area. I think many of you probably know that he's the one that gave the name Golden Gate to the Golden Gate. And so Here it is. Before there was a bridge, it was called the Golden Gate. But before John Fremont named it that, it was simply called the mouth of the port of San Francisco. Golden Gate, so much more dramatic. But more than that, he bought her 70 acres of land on what is now Fort Mason. It was an area called Black Point. And they had a home there. And this is a picture of Jesse looking out from that home. That land was seized by the government in 1863 because of the fear of Confederate raiders coming into San Francisco Harbor. And yesterday, my friend Linda Yee here took me on an adventure where we went and found the location of that house. You can find it. There's a plaque there at Fort Mason. What you really see there is a very, very large cannon, one that was capable of firing a 128-pound ball 2 miles into the harbor. It pretty much was there mostly for intimidation and not necessarily for accuracy. But this is something that I just love, to be able to actually go find that after I had read about it. You have other important parts of my story here, too. San Francisco played a critical role in the lives of Ellen and William Tecumseh Sherman. Now, you probably also know that William Tecumseh Sherman, when he was first stationed here during the Mexican War, was the man who figured out that this substance that came from Sutter's mill was actually gold. He used his training at West Point to do the chemical test to determine that it was gold. So he was sort of responsible for the gold rush in a way. But he was also a banker here after that war. And he, in fact, helped design and build a bank building that's at the corner of Montgomery and Jackson Street. It's still sort of informally called Sherman's Bank. It's one of the few buildings that survived the earthquake and fire. And so you can see that building that William Tecumseh Sherman worked as a banker in to this day. Now, Ulysses S. Grant also had a bit of a history here in San Francisco, although it was really more a stopping point and not a place that he lived. But we know that he came here because any time any military man or otherwise had to go into a northern military post, they had to stop in San Francisco first. And so Ulysses S. Grant did that, went up to Humboldt Bay, had a terrible experience there, left the Army. But when he was told, when he was advised that he was very likely to become president after the war, he wrote to his wife that one of his regrets on becoming president was that he would not be able to take her back to California because he really had wanted to come back here and live. So Ulysses S. Grant really felt very fondly about San Francisco. Now, you can find Grant Street and Sherman Street and Fremont Street. At least I haven't been able to find a McClellan Street. But for those of you who know about the Civil War and know about McClellan, you know that's not a great loss to the city of San Francisco. And if you don't, if you read my book, you'll quickly learn that. But another way that I try to make my talks more interesting even to me is that I try to put different slides in each talk. So I'm going to pay probably a little more attention to my notes because I want to be sure that I do go to the right slide at the time. This is my first book, and I was quite gratified by the response from various historians that I sent it to. Even some of the major biographers of the generals wrote that they felt that they learned more about the men than they knew from reading about my book about the wives. But the one blurb, as they call it, that I was most gratified with was this one, and I'll read it to you. Hooper's book is unique in the annals of Civil War history. Here I found Julia Grant, wife of Ulysses Grant, and my great-great-grandmother, as I had never known her before. Thoroughly researched and readable, the book is remarkably moving. And that was written by Ulysses Grant Dietz, who also serves as president of the Ulysses Grant Foundation. But It was interesting for me to see that somebody who was actually descended from one of the wives learned more about their grandmother, great-great-grandmother from my book than they had through their family history. I first became interested in this story 10 years ago when I went back to school to study military history, as Ellen said, to George Washington University. And I learned that Ellen Sherman went to see Abraham Lincoln in 1862, early 1862, when her husband was in trouble. From earlier reading, I knew that Jesse Fremont, this is Ellen Sherman here. From earlier reading, I knew that Jesse Fremont had gone to see Lincoln when her husband was in trouble. The two of them had very, very different results in their lobbying efforts with Lincoln. As a former congressional aide and lobbyist, I became very interested in, were there other women who did this and why did they have such different results? Was Lincoln amenable to being lobbied? I just knew that these wives that went to see Lincoln really did have an impact on their husbands' careers. And I was in part confident of that because I knew, growing up in a military family, how important wives are in the careers of military men. So I began with Jesse and with Ellen. And after my initial research, I thought I would try to look at the generals and try to find two other generals whose career trajectories in the Civil War sort of matched those of Jesse and Ellen. And what did I find? Well, I found that, this is Nellie McClellan. I found that her husband was made Major General in May of 1861 at the same time that Fremont was made Major General. But by the end of 1862, both of their husbands had been relieved of command. They never commanded any more troops in the Civil War. They lasted just little more than a year. So when I tried to look at Ellen Sherman and find a comparable career trajectory to her husband, it was Ulysses Grant, and here's Julia. So they started at the same time that these other two started as major generals. They barely got back into the army as colonels. But of course, after 4 years, they were at the very top of the grades. And of course, Ulysses Grant was lieutenant general. And so I thought, well, there's got to be something more here. And the more I dug, the more I realized that there were similarities between the two sets of generals, and there were similarities between the two sets of wives. You know the old adage, behind every great man, there's a great woman. I wanted to try to find how exactly that worked. And I also wanted to find out what happened. What about the women behind the not-so-great men? Early on, I realized that none of these women stayed in one place during the Civil War. And I decided I would map their travels. One of the things I always found most interesting about military history are the maps. And a good map in a book about a battle or a campaign can really make the difference between understanding a story and not. So I decided I would map the women's travels as most people have mapped the men's travels. Wisely, I decided to hire a cartographer, and I went online and I found a young man up in Madison, Wisconsin, who seemed to have a very good sort of background. He'd done some Civil War. He'd done lots of things. So I hired him to do the maps in my book. Last week, I had lunch with him. His name is Scott Zillmer. He's just been made the chief cartographer for National Geographic. I'm not going to take credit for that rise in his career, but I will say that he still believes that these maps are among the most interesting Civil War maps he's ever had a hand in. And I believe that they do tell a new story of the Civil War. interestingly, it wasn't until I was finished with all of them and I put them together and reflected on my research that I realized that the maps also tell a lot about the relationships between the men and women. They're almost a metaphor for these couples' relationships. So let's begin. Jessie Fremont was the woman that I thought I'd most admire as I began my research, but I soon changed my mind. From the start, I thought I knew a lot about her. She was smart, savvy, opinionated. She was educated to the max by her father. She was raised in a political family. Her parents doted on her, and they really set her up to be the belle of Washington society. At the age of 15, though, she fell in love with John Charles Fremont, who was then a very dashing young officer in the Army Topographical Corps. He was the man who made the maps for the expeditions that explored paths across America. Jesse's father was Senator Thomas Hart Benton, one of the first senators from Missouri and one of the most famous men in American politics. He is so admired that two of our presidents have written about him. Theodore Roosevelt wrote a biography of Thomas Hart Benton, and John F. Kennedy included him in his profiles in Courage. So he was a remarkable man. He was aghast at the thought that his young daughter would fall in love and want to marry John Fremont. He admired Fremont for what he was doing, opening up the West, but Fremont had been born out of wedlock and had not gone to West Point, so he had no social standing and very poor financial prospects. But Jessie was not to be denied. And when she was 17, she eloped with Fremont. In their 20 years of marriage, so that was in 1841 that they eloped, in their 20 years of marriage before the Civil War, Jessie's attitude toward her husband was very much like the unrelenting coaching of a stage mother. She really took tactical command of his career even before he became a commander. And she didn't change that during the Civil War. That had no impact on her. When her husband assumed command of the Western Military Department in July of 1861, and that command was really much of the St. Louis and Missouri area and west, Jessie followed him to St. Louis, and she set up an office in front of his office and acted as his unofficial chief of staff. Now think about this. You know, this is a woman in 1861. She's acting as his unofficial chief of staff in the middle of a war. In St. Louis, she was referred to as General Jessie. When her husband issued an emancipation order in Missouri in late August of 1861, without advising President Lincoln in advance, it was General Jessie who got aboard a train and went east to see Lincoln to try to get him to not order her husband to revoke his emancipation order. Lincoln at that point didn't believe that he had the authority as president to issue an emancipation order, and so certainly he did not believe that one of his generals did. He was concerned that soldiers were laying down their arms as a result of this emancipation order because they had signed up to reunite the Union and not to free slaves. But in fact, Fremont's reason for doing this was that he was hoping that it would encourage the rebels to lay down their arms and come back and not fight. But it had the opposite effect. So Jessie goes on a two-day train ride to Washington, D.C. She gets in to see President Lincoln at 9 o'clock or after on a busy evening in the Red Room. And in their late-night encounter, which was one of the most famous meetings in the White House during the Civil War, neither he nor she handled it very well. But most of the blame goes to Jesse. She demanded his personal correspondence with some of his cabinet members. She even intimated that her husband would challenge President Lincoln to a duel. She then, after the meeting, encouraged her husband to flout Lincoln's revocation order. She told him to print more copies of his emancipation order, which he did. When Lincoln learned about that, Lincoln relieved Fremont of command. And even though, that was in November of 1861, though Fremont was given another command in 1862 in Western Virginia, Jesse went with him there to Wheeling, West Virginia, and set up her office again inside his office and fought with him to the very bitter end, which for him came in November of 1862. Jesse fought for her husband always, and until in the election of 1864, when she derailed his candidacy for president against Lincoln because of a cartoon she saw in Harper's Weekly. George and Nellie McClellan are a fascinating, if infuriating, couple. He was a child prodigy from an upper-middle-class Philadelphia family who entered West Point at the age of 15. Nellie, whose story has never been told before my book, was a blue-eyed, celebrated beauty who turned down 8 marriage proposals before she finally accepted George McClellan's second proposal. On their wedding day in 1860, McClellan was president of the Illinois Central Railroad. A year and a half later, the 34-year-old was general-in-chief of all of the United States armies in the middle of a civil war. The McClellans were prominent on the social scene in Washington in the winter of 1861, even as the White House and Congress and newspapers fumed at him for not trying to attack the enemy. In Lincoln's words, McClellan had the slows. But in fact, the general had serious mental problems too. McClellan's daily letters to Nellie reveal that he was often deluded, always paranoid, and narcissistic in the extreme. Nellie fed her husband's disdain for Lincoln and his cabinet in her letters, and I'll take just a moment to let you appreciate the difficulties of some of the research that goes into books about the Civil War. This was a very popular writing style during that time. It was called cross-writing, and it was done in order to save postage because you could cram more in on a page. But just imagine trying to read that. People could do it then, and you can do it now, but it takes a lot of Advil to get through it. So in her letters, she egged him on in his tirades against Lincoln and his military superiors. Now, I think that Nellie might have realized that she married a very complex young man, but I don't think she could have imagined the consequences to the nation of her unquestioning support for his warped worldview. This is Nellie's map. Now, Nellie had joined her husband at his luxurious headquarters home on H Street in Washington in late 1861 when he took command of all Union forces. When McClellan finally moved his army south in April of 1862, Nellie began traveling north to New York and Connecticut and New Jersey. Indeed, more than once, she literally fled Washington to New York City to avoid criticism of her husband that was so rampant in the nation's capital. Lincoln relieved McClellan of command in the fall of 1862 after the Battle of Antietam, when he simply refused to try to chase the Confederates out of the North. And at that point, the McClellans fled to Europe for a time to escape his humiliation. When they returned, they spent most of their time in New York City, and they spent it in what was then called the Fifth Avenue Hotel, which was a well-known haunt of the most fervent anti-Lincoln Democrat politicians, who convinced McClellan to run for president against Lincoln in 1864. And I'll just take one moment, because we don't need to talk any more about politics than we absolutely have to, but think about this. In 1864, we're in the middle of a civil war. President Lincoln is running for president, and two of his generals are running against him. And McClellan did not even resign from the army. He was still in the army getting a paycheck while he was running for president against Lincoln. After he lost that election, they fled again to Europe. Now, we know that George loved Nellie. There's no question about that. But did Nellie love George? Though his biographers all state that as fact, in my opinion, the answer isn't really clear. I tell the tale of her engagement as a young woman to the man who was to become a very famous Confederate general, Ambrose Powell Hill. Her mother forced her to break off that engagement, and it was only much later then that she did accept George McClellan's wedding proposal. So there's a question there about whether she always continued to love A.P. Hill, whether she ever really loved McClellan, just from that evidence. But actually, I thought I found more evidence of her ambivalence toward her husband in what happened during the war and then later after his death. Unlike many Civil War widows, you can think of Libby Custer, you can think of Verena Davis, you can think of George Pickett's wife, Nellie completely abandoned any responsibility for her husband's legacy after his death. She left his legacy to the not-so-tender mercies of a very misguided literary executor who published what are the most inaccurate and most criticized memoirs of the Civil War. People thought that they had been written by McClellan, but they were not. They were written by his literary executor. And then he went one step further. He included copies of more than 200 of the letters between Nellie and George during the war, letters that she had to have allowed him to copy. She didn't necessarily do it because she wanted his legacy to be ruined, but she allowed it to happen. And in those letters, McClellan had just spilled out his vitriol against Lincoln, whom he called a baboon and a gorilla, against Secretary of War Stanton, whom he called a Judas, and against General-in-Chief Halleck, whom he called the devil. He and Nellie had written each other every day while they were apart, and he had often cautioned her to keep their opinions private. But somehow, the literary executor asked for the letters. She allowed the letters to be published. It is almost enough to make you feel sorry for George McClellan. Almost. In my opinion, if Jessie fought too hard for her husband, Nellie really didn't fight at all. So, unlike the other wives, Ellen Ewing met her husband as a child. They were neighbors in Lancaster, Ohio, where their fathers were best friends. When William Tecumseh Sherman's father died of typhoid, Ellen's father walked next door and offered to take in one of the 11 children left penniless and fatherless. And according to family legend, Cump, as he was called, Tecumseh somehow became Cump, was chosen because he was the brightest. So Ellen was 4 then, and Cump was 9. For most of their childhood, Ellen was away in Catholic boarding schools, and later Cump went to West Point. But they wrote to each other then and all their lives, long and interesting letters that transformed their friendship and foster sibling relationship into love. They were married in 1850 in Washington, across from the White House, at Francis Preston Blair's house, the Blair House, which Ellen's father was renting then. He was our first Interior Secretary. I learned that Ellen suffered from numerous illnesses all of her life. She died in 1882, at the age of 64 from heart failure. She was the only one of my wives to predecease her husband. But her worst ailment struck her in her youth. It's a form of external tuberculosis called scrofula. And I'm going to show you a picture that you're not going to want to see, but it's not of Ellen. It's of an anonymous victim of scrofula. It's not the worst picture, but it is a very typical picture of this disease. It was a widespread disease in those days before pasteurization, which was invented in 1864, since it was transmitted in raw milk from diseased cows. Scrofula is a terrible, disfiguring disease, as you can see, marked by huge boils on the neck and the jaw. They swell and they erupt, and then they temporarily subside, leading the person to think maybe they've been cured. They always come back. Ellen was plagued by scrofula all her life. I think it speaks volumes about Sherman's character that he could see past this terrible disease and love her and marry her. That they did love each other is obvious in their letters. From the earliest days of the war, when Ellen was in Ohio and Kampf was posted in Washington before the first Battle of Bull Run, she wrote to him often asking if she could bring their new baby, their sixth child, with her to Washington and stay with him. But Sherman was opposed to having women in camp. He camped with his men across the Potomac River near the Key Bridge and later criticized McClellan's luxurious lodgings. Nonetheless, Ellen did travel on more than one occasion to help her husband. In November of 1861, she raced from Louisville, Kentucky. She raced from Lancaster, Ohio to Louisville, Kentucky when the first reports of concern about her husband on the part of his superiors reached her. She took him to see a doctor. Sherman had been forced to take command of the Department of the Cumberland when General Robert Anderson's health failed. This was a post that Sherman had specifically asked Lincoln 3 months earlier that he not be given. He did not want to be given senior command. But when Anderson's health failed, Sherman had to take it. And Sherman began to be concerned that his troops were outnumbered, that they were still so poorly trained because they were new troops, and they were clearly not well armed. He began to show signs of a nervous breakdown. As he requested, he was soon relieved of command and moved to a less stressful duty. But because of that demotion that he had requested, on December 11th, newspapers around the country carried this startling headline, General William T. Sherman insane. And so in January 1862, Ellen traveled again on his behalf, this time to Washington to ask the President of the United States for help in restoring her husband's reputation. That meeting was far more productive than Jesse's had been, in large part because of Ellen's attitude toward Lincoln and her opinion of Lincoln. Sherman took the president's advice, as Ellen had told it to him, and was soon rising in the ranks. Again and again, Ellen asked Kampf if she could visit him in the field. He consistently refused until after the Union victory at Vicksburg, when he wrote to her that she and the children could come and visit him at a camp that he had on the banks of the Big Black River. Ever mindful of diseases in those days, like malaria, yellow fever, and the typhoid that had killed his father, he assured her in a letter, "I have a healthy camp." And Ellen took four of their six children with her to Mississippi. The Shermans, who had been apart for most of the war by that time, had a great time together until Grant ordered Sherman to relieve the siege of Chattanooga. As the Shermans left Vicksburg, it was clear that their youngest son, Willie, was not well, and almost as soon as they arrived in Memphis, the boy died, probably of typhoid. That was the last time Ellen traveled to be with Kampf during the war. She went back to Lancaster and buried her son, and soon her mother after that, while Kampf fought from Chattanooga south. In June of 1864, Ellen, who had become pregnant while at Vicksburg, bore another son, her seventh child, just before Atlanta fell and Sherman began his march to the sea. Cut off from communication along the way, he did not learn that baby Charles Sherman had died on December 4th. Until he arrived in Savannah at the end of December and read the obituary in the newspaper. For the rest of the war, Ellen and her children divided their time between Lancaster and Notre Dame, where the children were in school. So Jessie traveled in lockstep with her husband. Nellie traveled from her husband, and Ellen traveled to and fro. But Julia Grant was the Civil War's road warrior. Every biographer of Grant mentions that she was with him a lot, but they really don't say more than that. But her memoirs are full of tales of being in camp with Grant. And I know that the Confederates tracked her movements as actionable intelligence of what Grant was going to do. Her map that I made, like the other maps, is just an approximation. It doesn't show many of her smaller trips. No matter. It's clear that Julia traveled more than 10,000 miles during the Civil War to be with her husband. Why did Julia travel so much? I found the answer in her eyes. As amazing as it was that she traveled so far, often with four children in tow, sometimes through enemy territory, it's even more astonishing when you realize that she did it with a disability. Julia Grant was born with an eye defect called strabismus. It made her eyes look crossed, which embarrassed her all her life. She always preferred to be photographed in profile. It also made it difficult, but not impossible, for her to read and write. She almost certainly never saw anything in three dimensions, and she had no depth perception. And just think about that. That is not an insignificant concern in an era when you're traveling by horses and carriages and boats. But similar to Sherman's attraction to the disfigured Ellen, Ulysses Grant fell in love with Julia despite her disability. They fell in love and they stayed that way for nearly 40 years. Theirs is one of the great love stories of American history. But though Julia loved Grant, she broke his heart again and again when she failed to write to him. Time and again, he pleaded for information about their children. Does Fred have teeth yet? Asked if she had received valuable items he sent, like my Brigadier General's commission, and in hundreds and hundreds of letters over more than 20 years, he begged her over and over again to write to him more often. I needed to understand why she didn't. I first did a very close reading of her memoirs. She was the first First Lady to write her memoirs, or to dictate them. She dictated them. And her memoirs provide some important clues. But then I turned to medical expertise, including insights from one of Dr. Oliver Sacks's most famous case studies. In 1976, I read his case study in The New Yorker called Stereo Sue. It's about a woman who was born with strabismus, who grew up to become a neuroscientist, and didn't realize until she was an adult that she didn't see in three dimensions, that she had no depth perception. Her whole life, she saw everything in two dimensions. And she taught herself, she trained her eyes to see in three dimensions. And Oliver Sacks considered that one of his most amazing case studies. So, and she was a professor at Mount Holyoke, and she and I have emailed back and forth about Julia Grant, and it was fascinating research. So I go into considerable detail in my book about how Julia's eye defect was linked to her failure to write. Ulysses needed constant reassurance of Julia's love. He was different in that way from the other generals. He needed Julia, and he needed reassurance of her love. And it shook his confidence to the core when she didn't write. And so when Ulysses decided to return to the army in 1861 in the Civil War, Julia sought to overcome her inability to write to him on a regular basis. The first thing she thought she would do, and she offered, was to send their 11-year-old son, Fred, with him off to war. And Fred did go off. It's amazing. A number of young sons went with their fathers off to war. But as soon as they were called into battle, as soon as they were break camp to go into battle, Ulysses sent Fred back home. So then she had to decide what to do. And as amazing as it may seem, she decided she would travel to be with her husband rather than let him suffer the consequences of her not writing. So in the fall of 1861, Julia brought their four children with her from Galena, Illinois, to live with her husband at his headquarters in Cairo, Illinois. when Julia arrived in camp there, she also did something with Ulysses that had an enormous impact on our perception of Ulysses Grant. She badgered her husband to cut his beard until finally he did. If she hadn't won the Battle of the Beards, as I call it, you'd be carrying this around in your wallet instead of this. And this was a very, very unattractive beard that he had grown by October of 1861. To Cairo also, she brought her slave. Her slave was also named Julia, although she was called Jewel. We know that Abraham Lincoln knew that Julia Grant had a slave in camp with one of his up-and-coming brigadier generals. And though Lincoln was urged to dismiss Grant, he did not do it. The two Julias traveled together nearly 5,000 miles during the first 2 years of the war and came within hours of being captured by Confederates in Holly Springs, Mississippi, in December of 1862. The Confederates came to town literally hours after Julia had gotten on a train to go see Ulysses, and they came to the very house where Julia was staying and asked for Julia Grant, so they knew she was there, but she was gone. Julia Grant's wartime journeys are a remarkable demonstration of her devotion to her husband and a remarkable demonstration of their mutual love. As a result of these travels, she had a front row seat, as no other woman did, to the end game of the Civil War. First of all, Julia and their youngest son, Jesse, lived with Grant at his headquarters in City Point from January until April, until the surrender of Lee to Grant. And then when she went to Washington with Grant right after the surrender, and on April 14th, she refused Mary Lincoln's invitation to go to Ford's Theater with the Lincolns. And that's a fascinating story, of course. Even though the newspapers had announced it, because Mary Lincoln told them that she was inviting them, Julia Grant would have refused to go because she had had such a bad experience with Mary Lincoln while at City Point. So why were Fremont and McClellan so unsuccessful as generals and Sherman and Grant so successful? Of course, there are many reasons, but I think an important part of the reason is to be found in the women that they chose as their wives. I hope you've enjoyed this. Thank you.
To remind our audiences that they're listening to Candace Shy Hooper speaking about her book, Lincoln's General's Wives. And it's time to ask questions.
Thank you. Is there any evidence that Julia's reluctance to write to Grant was in any way responsible for his decision to resign from the Army when he was stationed in California? And which is usually attributed to a difficulty with his superior Buchanan and the accusation of drunkenness. Mm-hmm. And then related to that is, I think the answer is no, but did he ever say anything in his letters to Julia intimating that he had this intention of resigning?
The answer to the first part of your question is that her failure to write to him clearly had a great deal to do with him resigning from the Army. It may have led him to drink more than he would have, but it certainly led him to be very depressed. And it was clear in the letters that he sent. There was one point at which he received a letter from her with the outline of the hand of their newborn son, and he was in tears as he was showing it to one of his officers. So it is very clear that he was very depressed that she wasn't with him, that she didn't write to him, and it's a bleak and lonely place in Humboldt Bay at that time. So all of that did have something to do with it, and I'm going to ask you to remind me about the second part of your question.
In his letters to Julia, did he intimate that he was thinking about this?
No, he didn't. In fact, he did not. He only sent his father a letter saying he was going to resign, but he only sent Julia a letter saying that he was going on leave, and so it was he really didn't tell her that.
Were there parts of time that she wrote more letters and then others that she didn't, or was it had to do with her eyesight, maybe that she didn't like to write letters? Or,
well, I think what it was that I think the reason behind this, what I've pieced together, is that if you're born with strabismus, you have difficulty in a lot of different ways in just dealing with your surroundings. And either your parents can try to impose some self-discipline and teach you self-discipline, and you can learn how to overcome those problems. Robert Todd Lincoln had strabismus, but his parents made sure that he learned how to deal with his disability. But Julia's parents did not. She was carried to school by her brothers on a sedan chair so that she wouldn't stumble. She was never, she didn't have to learn math or Roman numerals. She was always indulged, and everything came out all right. And I think that that is really what happened when she would get these letters from Ulysses Grant begging her to write. And she'd really want to write. She loved him, but he was going to be okay even if she didn't write. She never had any self discipline. She was never, her parents never taught her the value of that.
You mentioned that Julia Grant had some problems with Mary Todd Lincoln in City Point. Could you elaborate a little bit on that? And did any of the other wives have any interactions that you found with the president's wife?
I can elaborate on that at great length, but I can give you just a couple of examples. It was clear from the beginning, the first day that Mary Lincoln arrived at City Point, and Julia was the one that invited them there, so we will start with that. She wanted them to come. But when Julia was invited by Mary Lincoln to sit in the room, Julia made the mistake of actually sitting on the same sofa that Mary Lincoln was sitting on. That was not to be done. And when she left the room, she was expected to really sort of back out of the room like you do with the Queen of England. Mary Lincoln had a sense of royalty, of imperiousness. And understand, though, that at that time, the role of the First Lady still wasn't clearly defined, so she took on the imperial trappings. There were a number of other episodes that happened during that time that involved where she was riding in a carriage with the two women were riding in carriages together to try to catch up with their husbands who were reviewing troops, and they never quite made it, and the carriage rides got worse, and Mrs. Lincoln got more upset. So it was. There's a lot of very lively reading in that part of the book, I can assure you. Did the other wives have interactions with them? Really not so much. None of them really spent much time in Washington, although Mrs. Sherman did a little bit. And so Julia only really encountered her because Mary Lincoln came to her camp, and then she went to Washington.
Next question.
Oh, there's one back there.
Can you elaborate a little bit about what they did, I forget who it was, when they went to Europe and the perspective of Europeans of the Civil War? Obviously, you have, the history of the United States, the Revolution, but what was the perspective and their writing at that time while they were kind of in Europe hiding?
For the McClellans, that was whom I spoke about, who actually went to Europe during the war, they were really trying to flee, as I said, his humiliation. And so they did the grand tour of Europe. They were going to look at the sites and all. But in fact, George McClellan kept up a very strong correspondence back in the States. In fact, at the end of Sherman's march from Atlanta to the sea, McClellan sent Sherman a congratulatory letter saying that it was a feat that nobody could have imagined could have been done. And then at the end of the war, there is this one letter that is really so fascinating to me, and it is that it comes when they've learned that Lincoln has been assassinated. And McClellan says, you know, while we've been enjoying the sights of Europe, he's talking to a friend of his, you know, you've gone through this, he used the word wonderful in the 19th century sense of wonder, amazement, a shock, wonderful transition of, you know, feelings from, you know, joy to sadness. And in that same letter, he sent the news that he had gotten the news that A.P. Hill had been killed in Petersburg just 2 weeks before the end of the war. So Nellie McClellan would have learned that her, that the man that she'd been engaged to had just been killed. Okay, that's one of my
favorite. You mentioned that McClellan was in charge of a big railroad in Illinois or Indiana?
Illinois Central Railroad.
So he had a lot of independent wealth, I would take it.
His family was wealthy in Philadelphia, but in fact, as president of the Illinois Central Railroad, he was one of the highest paid people in the United States. His salary was $10,000. It was twice what the president of the United States made. So yes, he never, of all of these couples, never worried for money. Of course, the Fremonts, their fortunes went up and down. They owned land in near Yosemite, on which was found just a huge gold deposit. And yet, Fremont was such a poor manager of investments and mining that he boomed as much as he busted. And then Sherman and Grant, they were in terrible financial straits really until the war, when they got a steady paycheck. And then after the war, as they really got firmly on their feet in business.
I'm just wondering if you can discuss the apparent contradictions between Julia Grant and Jewel, what the interactions were, if there were any recorded.
Well, there were. In fact, I wrote an article for the New York Times about this about 2 years ago. And there's not a whole lot about it, but Julia was raised in a slave-owning family. Her father owned a plantation outside of St. Louis. And when she was born, she was given Jewel as her slave. And the woman was probably not too much older than her and was with her constant companion for 35 years. Julia also owned three other slaves. This was something that Ulysses Grant never liked slavery, but he loved Julia, and it was a constant, tension within his family. His parents, his father had apprenticed with John Brown's father, was very anti-slavery. They did not even come to their wedding because there was such strong anti-slavery feelings in the Grant family. But when he married Julia, Ulysses promised her father that he would take good care of her, and that encompassed this notion that she had this disability and she had to have additional help. And so Jewel traveled with them. When the Emancipation Proclamation was signed, January 1st, 1863, in Julia Grant's memoir, she says her slaves were freed then. Jewel continued to travel with them, as so many other house slaves often did, as a paid servant from that time on. But as long as they were in the South, the Emancipation Proclamation kept her free. But at one point, Julia had to go back to Missouri because her son Fred was ill. And she tried to take Jewel with her, and Jewel ran away then because she would have been susceptible to being enslaved again in Missouri. We know from Julia Grant's memoirs that Jewel got married shortly after that. And then I later found out by reading one of Jesse Grant's letters, you know, the young boy there, that for the rest of her life, every year on Jesse's birthday, he would get a letter from Jewel asking for a present, which he always sent. It's a very, very complicated situation. And it really is an insight into just how complicated it can be. These two women traveled together during the war. Their wars were very different, what they saw and what they lived through.
Speaking of complications, you mentioned that Lincoln overturned one of his generals' Emancipation Proclamation. A lot of people think of the whole war as being fought to free the slavery, but as you said, to get it started, that really wasn't the stated motive.
That's absolutely true. I mean, Lincoln came into office as somebody who was going to keep the status quo. He didn't want slavery to be expanded into the territories, but he did not come into office saying he was going to get rid of it in the states where it existed. And so that was the rallying cry when the South seceded, was to keep the status quo, to bring the states back in. And so this early Emancipation Proclamation by Fremont was just incited the fears of all of the slave-owning population in the border states, that any general could free slaves anywhere. And what was interesting is that Fremont was the first, but he was not the only. There were two other generals that later also tried to do it, even though they saw the example of Fremont.
Yes, it's my understanding that when he was president, Grant had both his father and his father-in-law staying in the White House. And do you have anything to say about how Julia handled that situation?
You know, that's absolutely true. You know a great deal about this. Julia's father never wanted her to marry Ulysses. He did not think that life as a military wife was right for his daughter, his beloved daughter, Julia. And when Ulysses then signed up on the Union side, he told Julia that she was always welcome in his home, but Ulysses would never have a plate at his table again. So he was very upset. He was much more on the Southern. He was much more of a Southern sympathizer. I think Julia was a master diplomat because she could deal with both the anti-slavery father-in-law and the pro-slavery father in the White House and in other times. I mean, it was a difficult balancing game, but she seemed to do it well. And as everybody seems to say, she was the first lady who most loved being first lady.
Any other questions? There's time for one more. Could you say something about how, maybe you don't know, but it's at the end of Ulysses Grant's life. He wrote his memoirs, and who published them and who put it together?
That's a fascinating story. Ulysses Grant, when he decided to run for president and he left the Army, he lost his Army pension. When he left the presidency, he had no presidential pension. He went into business, financial business, with one of his sons, and who was also in business with a man named Ward, and who turned out to be a total crook. And who completely bankrupted the Grants over a period of just days. They lost hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars, not only of their money, but of his friend's money, who had invested it with them. Within months after that happened, in May of 1882, Ulysses Grant found out that he had throat cancer and he was dying. And so here he was, both destitute and dying, and trying to figure out how to take care of his wife, whom he loved. And people approached him to write articles and memoirs. And the Century Magazine wanted to publish his memoirs. But Mark Twain found out about it. And Mark Twain, who admired Ulysses Grant, didn't know him well, but admired him greatly, got a look at the contract that Century was going to give Grant and was furious about it and said he would publish Grant's memoirs. And then the journey that they went on for 2 years, or for just a little bit over a year, actually, to write that memoir, Grant wrote two volumes. He finished them 4 days, the last word, 4 days before he died. Within a year, Mark Twain gave Julia a check that was the equivalent of $500,000 in royalties. And so it is one of the great all-time stories of in the publishing industry. I have a little side story to that, one that I tell a little bit in this story, is that by coincidence, not by coincidence, but Mark Twain also published these McClellan memoirs that were so bad and so terrible and so salacious. And I often wonder whether, in fact, he didn't do that just because it so showed such a contrast with the man that he admired, Grant.
Right, that's a great way to end the whole story. Well, thank you very, very much for coming. Thank you, great Candace, for the... And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 114th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much for coming.